This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Five men involved with the Madrid subway bombings of 2004 and eight men who set off for Iraq to wage jihad against Americans came from one small town in Morocco called Tetouan. Most of them were from a neighborhood within it called Jemaah Mazouak. Why is this town turning out terrorists? That's what my guest Andrea Elliott investigated in her article, Where Boys Grow Up to Be Jihadis, which was the cover story of this week's New York Times Magazine. Elliott won a Pulitzer Prize earlier this year for her series of articles called An Imam in America. The town of Tetouan is on the northern tip of Morocco, just a few miles from the Mediterranean Sea, not far from Spain. In fact, many young men leave Tetouan to find work and new opportunities in Spain. Elliott went to that town to interview family, friends, and neighbors of the jihadis. I asked her if there was any connection between the young men from Tetouan involved in the Madrid subway bombings and those who set off for Iraq.
There were several connections between these two groups. Two of the men who had died in Madrid after carrying out the attacks had a brother who remained in Morocco, who eventually was arrested along with a number of other people, and charged with recruiting and financing for this group of men who inevitably ended up going to Iraq. The more meaningful connection between these two groups, I think, was a connection of ideology and influence. I would say that there was a bit of a domino effect in this neighborhood, because when news of the bombings in Madrid hit, while most people that I talked to were really, really shocked and appalled, some of the young men in the neighborhood just became curious about the jihadi movement. And that curiosity wasn't just a kind of random general curiosity that one might have, but a very personal curiosity, given that they knew these men, some of them knew these men in Madrid and had really grown up alongside them, and in a sense felt that they knew their hearts. And as horrific as this violence may have seemed to a lot of the people around them, I think that there was the notion that because they knew them, their motivations couldn't have been all that misplaced. So I think it just really planted a seed or even just a question, which was, why would these guys we know in Madrid do this? And kind of just set them on what was really a new course for them, because in Morocco, terrorism is still largely a new phenomenon. The first major event in Morocco since its independence was the suicide bombings in Casablanca in 2003. So while you've seen certainly, you know, exported jihad, Moroccans going to places like Chechnya and Afghanistan, a small number of them, this event in Madrid was really anathema to people and shocking. And yet, I do think it sort of planted a seed in the minds of some of these kids.
Well, what was the new course that set them on? How did their lives change after they saw the results of the Madrid train attacks?
They became really consumed by news of the war. I think it sort of set them on two tracks. First, they just wanted to understand what this whole jihadi movement was about and became very focused on understanding more about what the Quran says and the Sunnah, and began talking to an imam in the neighborhood who, by many accounts, including the Moroccan government officials I talked to, was very influential on them. But at the time, they were sort of comfortably, quietly talking about this, and it was just interesting for me to see how they connected the dots, taking the war and what they felt outraged by, namely contractors profiting off of Iraqis, off of the war itself, and also, you know, videos that they had come across on the internet, because at a certain point, television coverage became insufficient. So these images that they would see of soldiers barging into homes, taking all of that stuff and applying it to a larger ideology that kind of says the West is at war with Islam. The war in Iraq is not a kind of confined conflict, but a global struggle.
Now, what about their mosque? You write that their imam ended up being a recruiter for jihadis in Iraq. He arranged ways for these men to journey to Iraq. Tell us a little bit more about what you learned about their imam.
The imam was very popular in the neighborhood among some people because he was young and really affable, and he recited the Quran with a very melodious voice, and people were taken with him. He led prayers at a mosque that was never given the official government stamp, and he would talk to the young people who came to his mosque in the evenings, and he was sort of like a friend and brother to them, and in some ways stood in contrast to the other imams in this neighborhood. This neighborhood has a lot of mosques, at least 10 by my count. And the older imams, I think, were perceived by some of these guys as sort of stiff and set in their ways. And this guy was just, something about him, I think, struck them. A lot of people I talked to, their eyes would light up when they described him, even though he's now in jail. And the Moroccan authorities claim that he's the recruiter. Somebody with a lot of information about this group, who was very good friends with a lot of them, who I talked to at length, believes that, yes, he may have actually connected them to people who were financing and arranging these trips, but didn't recruit them, that they really essentially recruited themselves and found a way to get there through him. Exactly how he fits into this, I think, remains a bit of a riddle.
Why is he in jail?
After these five men left the neighborhood and news of this began to spread, the Moroccan authorities just set out to crush this and arrested a number of people, more than 20 people, including the imam, from around the country, not just in Tetouan, and charged them with arranging trips and financing them into Iraq with the assistance of al-Qaeda in North Africa.
Did these young men, before leaving for Iraq, tell their families where they were going and why?
The sense I got was they actually took pains not to tell anybody where they were going, possibly because they felt that it would endanger their families. This is a country that has dealt with quite an aggressive approach by the government in prosecuting terrorism. And they just also didn't want anything standing in between them and their voyage. So news really came to the families once they had left. A number of them called home and asked for forgiveness. And
forgiveness for what?
Well, it's an interesting question because the phrase that they used, translated in English, reads, "Forgive me if I have done you wrong," or "Forgive me my mistakes." And this is a phrase that one hears commonly in the north of Morocco when people are saying goodbye before going on a long journey. So it's not entirely clear. There are a lot of rules, none of them official necessarily, but the mores of this whole jihadi movement are still taking shape. And a lot of people believe, for instance, that it's important to ask your parents' permission before leaving, to pay off your debts, and to pray, to be a good person. So I think that possibly some of it was that they hadn't asked for permission. And this is something that they were criticized quite a bit for in the neighborhood after leaving.
What do you think their expectations were about what they would do in Iraq? Do you think that they went with the idea of becoming suicide bombers or of something else?
Exactly what they expected, I don't think we'll ever know, because they're missing, with the exception of two who appear to have been detained in Syria. But the sense I got from people who knew them really well was that they were prepared to be quote-unquote martyrs, that they were prepared to give up their lives in order to defend Muslim land. The sense I got from talking to U.S. military officials is that many of the foreign fighters who get to Iraq arrive with this notion, sold to them often by imams in their hometowns, that they will be fighting some kind of heroic battle, only to find that they will in fact be deployed on suicide missions targeting other Muslims. And many officials have asserted, U.S. officials, that the majority of these attacks are carried out by foreign fighters, the suicide attacks directed at other Muslims. And so there may be a real degree of deception or disillusionment in terms of what people wind up doing versus what they expect. But in the case of this group, it's not clear exactly what they expected to do.
Yeah, I know you mentioned that a lot of the foreigners who go to Iraq to fight jihad or deploy to suicide bombers against other Muslims. But in the case of this group of young men who came from the small town in Morocco, their imam told them that Shiite Muslims weren't genuine Muslims, that they were basically unfaithful.
Yes.
So I'm thinking maybe they wouldn't have been that upset if they were in a suicide bombing against Shia.
That was an anecdote that really stood out to me as meaningful, because certainly people must realize, and certainly by the time that they left, they should have known that a lot of these attacks were directed at other Muslims. This is no secret. And the fact that he felt this way and that he had a role of influence in their lives, I think, certainly indicates that they may have agreed that such an attack would have been okay.
So how many people from Tetouan in Morocco who set out for Iraq to become jihadists actually made it to Iraq?
Well, we don't really know. Eight set out to Iraq, and two of the eight were detained in Syria. Some of the others did make it in. Their identities have not been confirmed to me. One senior military official told me that possibly some of them had either died or been detained, but exactly what happened to them isn't known. There was a raid in September of a militant safe house of sorts in Iraq, where soldiers seized a trove of documents that looked like kind of like intake forms for foreign fighters arriving in Iraq, with their names and their countries of origin and how much money they had and details about their families. And some of these forms were found for at least some of the five men from Tetouan who had possibly made it that far.
My guest is Andrea Elliott. We're talking about her New York Times Magazine cover story, Where Young Men Grow Up to Be Jihadis. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter Andrea Elliott. She wrote the Times Magazine cover story, Where Boys Grow Up to Be Jihadis, about a town in Morocco that seems to be breeding terrorists. Most recently, eight men from the town left for Iraq to wage jihad against Americans. The men from this town in Morocco were inspired to become jihadis in part because other men from their neighborhood had been behind the Madrid train bombings in 2004. And those men really went up in a blaze. I mean, they were in a house together when the police were about to break in, and they blew themselves up. And some of them, shortly before they blew themselves up, were on the phone home saying goodbye. So it was a really dramatic end to a really dramatic story. And in the minds of these men, a very successful story, because they pulled off this horrible attack in Madrid. Now, the men from this town who went to Iraq kind of fizzled. Nobody really knows what happened to them. Nobody knows if they succeeded in accomplishing any attacks in Iraq. So what's their legacy in this town? Do you think they're inspiring more jihadis or not?
I think it's hard to say. Certainly, in the wake of their departure, there's been such a focus by the government to clamp down on this that it seems to have stemmed the flow, at least according to officials and locals I talked to. They didn't leave behind any videos, as far as I know, and there are no posters, for instance, exalting them, because, as one person put it to me, such a thing would be forbidden in Morocco. I think that people in the neighborhood are, in large part, very bothered by it, but certainly they have their champions. The Madrid bombings, I think, brought a much more unanimous kind of disapproval and dismay on the part of people in this neighborhood. I encountered more nuance in the descriptions of how people felt about the Iraq group than I did about the Madrid group.
What do you mean?
Well, it's funny. The Madrid group, everyone kept telling me when I interviewed people about this sort of again and again, that they're terrorists, that what they did is awful, that killing innocent people is not jihad. And I think that the reason they feel this way in large part is because this region of Morocco, and in particular this city, is very connected to Spain. A lot of people have family living in Madrid who could have been affected by the bombings. They feel like they're a part of Spain in some ways. So they're very disapproving of that. But when it comes to the Iraq group, I just detected, you know, more hesitancy to write them off as terrorists. A lot of people that I talked to felt that they really qualified more as resistance fighters, not as terrorists. One person in particular comes to mind, because this neighborhood really has a love-hate relationship with the United States, and this one person who's a wedding planner, a young guy, went to great pains to explain to me why these guys were resistance fighters, not terrorists, that they were defending Muslim land that had been taken. And we got into long debates about the meaning of jihad. I wanted to understand what he meant. And at one point I asked him why they couldn't have done a different kind of jihad to work to improve the conditions of their lives, for instance. And his response to me was, well, why didn't George Bush work on the United States? He went and occupied Afghanistan instead. Yet a few weeks ago when I checked in with him, he rather gleefully told me that he had applied for the visa lottery to come live in the United States. So this is the kind of duality that I encountered again and again in the neighborhood. It's just an interesting chasm in the neighborhood between how they feel about U.S. foreign policy and how they feel about American culture. And
well, I think this ambivalence about America can also be summed up in things like popular culture. I mean, you describe how like one of the suicide bombers in the Madrid attacks who came from this town wore his hair like John Travolta. I'm not sure from which movie.
Saturday Night Live. Saturday Night Fever.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, some of them listened to hip hop. I mean, you know, they liked a lot about American culture. And this, you hear a lot about this among militant Muslims that, you know, that on the one hand, they emulate American popular culture. And on the other hand, they hate so much about America and want to kill Americans in Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, I think the line is drawn between culture and policy. And this is what I encountered again and again and again in this neighborhood, was just this real love-hate relationship with America. The most popular spot to congregate for men is Chicago Cafe, right in the middle of the heart of Jemima's Walk. Yet, as soon as I would tell people where I was from, they immediately wanted to talk about the war in Iraq. And I just heard again and again, you know, your president is the biggest terrorist in the world. One man who told me that was wearing a baseball cap with America spelled across the front in gold as he said this. So there is this real duality there. And I'm sure that some of these men who turned to terrorism in both the Madrid and Iraq groups from this neighborhood lived that very much. In particular, one guy who dreamed of being a stand-up comedian and wrote his own songs and listened to 50 Cent and Eminem and had a song by Eminem that derided President Bush translated into Arabic. There's just a real engagement in American culture and rejection of the United States in terms of its policy.
Were you able to talk with mothers of the suicide bombers or would-be suicide bombers?
Yes.
Tell us some of the responses you got from mothers about their sons' actions.
There was a tremendous amount of resistance to believing this could be true, and just enormous grief. I kept hearing, he's coming back, he really went to Spain. I see him in my dreams walking down the road, Eunice Ashbach's mother told me. You asked about the legacy earlier. One of the hardest things about the fact that we don't know what happened to them is the kind of tricks that this plays on the minds of their relatives and the people that they left behind, because they can't quite close the door. They just don't know. One mother said to me, I just want to see a piece of his bone. That's all I want to see, just to be sure that he did this. The mothers I talked to were really horrified by the notion that their sons would be capable of this kind of destruction and violence. And, you know, one mother said to me, if your child has a fever, you can feel it. You know, how couldn't I have felt it if they were dead? So I think that they just don't want to believe it.
So what do you feel like you walk away knowing that you didn't know before, after investigating this story?
One of the things that always frustrates me, and I think a lot of my colleagues, about terrorism coverage, because it's the position that we're placed in after a big event happens, is how little is understood about these people. So either they've killed themselves and you can't get to them, or they're locked up because the plot has been foiled. And in the aftermath of whatever event it is that you're covering, people are understandably scared. And so you don't really get much of a sense of who they are. And there are plenty of people who are members of groups or who belong to groups of circles of friends who sympathize with this and who don't actually follow through. And I guess I don't feel fully satisfied that I understand what it is that, you know, enables someone to actually be willing to give up his or her life. I did get the sense with one of them that there was a lot of trepidation and second guessing and doubts after he left Morocco, because he called back 5 or 6 times from Syria to his home. And this was one of the more powerful things that I came across in talking to people who knew him well, including family members, was that he just seemed so distant on the phone. He was trying to pretend that everything was normal and asking questions like, had his brother done his homework? And yet he was about to go kill himself or potentially die fighting a battle that it sounded like he was suddenly worried he should have never signed up for. So I guess I have a lot of questions about what happens once they do jump cross over the line, not just what pushes them over, but then once they get there, what is that process like? And those are things that I wish we knew more about.
Andrea Elliott, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Andrea Elliott is a reporter for the New York Times. Her Times Magazine cover story, Where Boys Grow Up to Be Jihadis, was published Sunday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.